Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
Osiris. Welcome to Wheels Off, a show about the messy reality of the creative life. I'm Rhett Miller. That's when it got wheels off. We started up and we ain't gonna stop. Oh, she made me feel like a god. That's when it got wheels off. Lucinda Williams, does she really need any introduction? If you don't know Lucinda Williams and her brilliant catalog of music, I would highly recommend that you pause this introduction and go listen to Car Wheels on a Gravel Road, for instance. Really anything from her decades-long career. It all holds up. It's all great. The poetry of her lyrics, the magic of her melodies. She is a vivacious rock and roll hero. Certainly a hero of mine. I've gotten to know her over the years and consider her a friend. To watch her resilience in the post-stroke world in which she finds herself after having had a stroke a couple of years ago. She's just so kick-ass, you guys. She no longer is able to play guitar, but she is still rocking, and she sings better than ever, which we address at one point during this conversation. She has a new memoir out and a new album out, the memoir Don't Tell Anybody the Secrets I Told You, the album Stories from a Rock and Roll Heart. They're both great. The memoir is chock full of funny, fascinating, behind-the-scenes dirt, and just really, you know, deep thoughts, great. She's got a great perspective on what it means to spend a life being creative, creating art. Her new album is good as anything she's ever recorded. She's so great, you guys. Honestly, this conversation was so fun to have and means a lot to me to get to talk to her, pick her brain, but also honor her for the example that she sets for me and everyone else who does this job or any job in the field of the arts. She's as good as it gets. Please welcome to Wheels Off, the great Lucinda Williams. Welcome to Wheels Off, Lucinda Williams. How are you, my friend?
I'm pretty good. Fair to middling.
I know that feeling. So fair for the edification of our listeners, from where are you logging in?
Nashville, Tennessee, nice. At my house.
It looks pretty. You got a lot of light in that room. Thank you. I like it.
Yeah.
Hey, congrats on the new record and the book. It's so exciting.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
I got to hear a sneak preview of the songs when we played together back in February, and everything just sounds so good. Does it feel good to play these songs live?
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
And I felt like your voice sounded better than ever in a lot of ways.
Lot of people have said that, like, I sound better than I did before I had my stroke.
What is up with that?
I don't know. It's weird.
Are you working on anything now beyond the promotion of those things, or are you just focusing on touring and stuff?
Yeah, mostly touring and all that and press.
I remember
this thing with you.
I know.
But But I'm also working on new songs. You know, I'm always trying to write more stuff, you know. And I've been doing, a lot of times I do these side projects, like I just recorded a Lou Reed song for a tribute album.
Which one?
And I did Legendary Hearts.
Oh, wow. Deep cut.
Office. He didn't want... Yeah, they didn't want the Velvet Underground. It has to be something from Lou Reed's solo career. So,
did your paths ever cross with Lou Reed?
Yeah. I got to go see him one time in L.A. and I met him and everything, and got to go back. Someone who worked with him took me. So we got introduced after his show and everything.
I've heard stories that he's famously ornery, but I've also heard that he's really sweet. So I imagine to you, I'm going to guess that he was the latter.
He was real sweet. Yeah.
Oh, man. Was it? See, I'm already asking you questions about, you know, like fun encounters in your life. Was it weird plumbing all those memories for the memoir?
A little bit, you know, because you don't want to. Well, I didn't want anybody to feel weird or feel bad about anything I said, so I kind of tiptoed around some of that stuff, you know, like old boyfriends and, you know, that kind of thing.
I know. I wonder, have you encountered, you don't have to get into it, but have you encountered much blowback? Have you had to been called to task?
I haven't yet, actually.
Good.
I hoped I didn't use the word smitten too many times. And I don't know what people are going to think about, you know, well, how many guys was she with? And, you know, like I mentioned who it was, you know, I said the names. So, but I wanted to tell the truth. And I thought people would enjoy knowing, you know, I mean, I'm not going to go into detail about, you know, the encounter itself, you know, but, you know, I would just describe meeting a certain person and how I was smitten right away, you know, and all that.
Which is a really sweet way to put it, I feel like.
It is, isn't it? Smitten. I like that word.
You know, it's funny. I wonder if folks from, you know, listening to your songs over the years would think of you as someone who's kind of, I don't know, like really tough in a lot of ways. Maybe it's the gravelly voice, maybe it's the persona. But in my interactions with you, I found you to be very sweet.
I think I'm sweet. I think I come across sweet. Part of that's that Southern thing, you know, because I'm a Southern woman. And us Southern girls grow up being taught certain things and, you know, don't do something, you know, that's not ladylike.
Yeah.
You know, I got that a lot when I was growing up, you know, so.
But I feel like one of the reasons you're such a role model, especially for young female artists coming up, is that because you are such a strong woman and you've always made a point to stand up for yourself.
Yeah, I like to think that I have that I make that impression.
In fact, sometimes a little ornery.
Yes, I can be ornery.
I remember a show we did together at Red Rocks one time. I don't know if you remember this. And the backstage situation was a little uncomfortable. And
I kind of remember.
In protest, you might have gone over the allotted time.
Yeah, there was something with that. Wasn't Ryan? Was Ryan Adams on the... Yeah.
And he would not let any of us into the proper backstage accommodations. And you played, I think, until about midnight.
Sorry. God, I didn't realize that. I forgot about that.
That was a good one, though. He was apoplectic. He didn't take the stage till almost 1 a.m. to a half full auditorium. But you know what? Guess who was in the right?
Lucinda Williams. He was ornery. He was being ornery.
Yeah, he was. So I wonder, do you remember when this all first started for you? And I'm sure you must have revisited these memories for the book. Do you remember, was there an epiphany moment when you knew that you were going to make a life in rock and roll?
I want to think that it was when I very first listened to Highway 61 Revisited, Bob Dylan's eponymous album that came out in 1965, which was the same year I started taking guitar lessons. And, you know, that was the height of the folk boom that was happening, you know. And I'd already been listening to a bunch of folk singers. And, you know, he was one of them, of course. And so everything kind of came together during that same time. And I was only 12 then, but I remember listening to that album and just loving it. I didn't understand all the words and everything, but, you know, there was something about it that the way he took traditional music and put that together with this very literary, you know, poetic writing just blew my mind. On some level, I understood it, even though I was only 12. Maybe because my father was a poet. And so I grew up around in that literary world, but also was listening to Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger and all that, you know.
Do you remember the first song you wrote?
Yeah. I think I was about 14, maybe. It was called The Wind Blows. I wasn't aware of double entendres at that time, you know. And it was just, it was so simple, just like a child's view of things, you know. The wind blows, and it went like, the wind blows, and it blows through the town, and the people in the town hear it blow. The wind blows, and it blows through the town, and the people in the town hear it blow. And then I went through and said, the leaves fall, and they fall to the ground, and the da-da-da-da-da. You know, because I've been listening to melodies really attracted to me. And these great songs were on the radio during that time. Like there was one called Today. And I can't remember who recorded it, but it was just really pretty song. And it's something like, today, while the blossoms still cling to the vine, I'll taste your strawberries, I'll drink your sweet wine. A million tomorrows may all pass away. The da 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 today. You know, just these really beautiful melodies like that would stream out of the radio and I would hear them and absorb, you know, that sound and everything.
You know, it's funny when songwriter friends of mine will talk about you, everybody sort of winds up talking about your poetry and you as a poet and your lyrics. But it hit me watching you play when I most recently saw you. Your melodies are so much better than most people that do, you know, kind of in the world that we live in, where it tends to be very... I think it was like Essence or something that was just that I've always thought of as a really pretty simple song. The melody on it, God, it's such an earworm and it just blew me away.
Thank you. That means a lot because melodies have always been important to me. And like I was saying, I've always been attracted to, you know, those like the great pop songs of the 60s, you know, had these great melodies. And that's what drew me in initially. And I mean, I think that's what blew my mind about Bob Dylan when he did that, when he entered into his folk rock stage, you know, because he had these great melodies with these amazing lyrics. And at some point in my little 12-year-old mind, I decided that's what I want to do. I want to somehow find that combination the way he did, you know.
Yeah, I think you've done it.
Oh God, Rhett. Thank you.
I wonder because in the book you talk a lot about songwriting as therapy, you know, and how you've used your, you know, your job to work through your you know, the stuff that you come up against internally. And I wonder, maybe in addition to that, if there is anything in addition to that, or if that's it, what have you come up with as strategies for dealing with internally generated obstacles, like the negative voices in your head, or like Roseanne Cash talked about success guilt or imposter syndrome, that kind of stuff. How do you deal with that?
Somebody asked me about imposter syndrome once. I didn't know about that, but I was doing an interview recently and he said, "Do you think you might have imposter syndrome?" I said, "What's that?" And then he explained it to me.
Clearly not.
Well, that's a good question and kind of hard to answer. Easy to understand and hard to answer, maybe. How do I deal with the demons that come in, kind of? Writing is very therapeutic for me. That is how I deal with a lot of that stuff. You know, there's something about forming these sentences, these words and lines and everything, and putting them on paper. There's something about doing that that feels good. It's very cathartic. You know,
I remember when Car Wheels came out, people wrote a lot about that record being a really therapeutic record for you.
Yeah, I was thinking about my childhood a lot on that one, and I still write a lot about things from my childhood, looking back, and you know, sorry, I wish I could.
No, it's good. The work speaks for itself. That's why we don't have to talk so much. No, that's good. I wonder, somebody said to me once, and this is a theory I've kind of liked myself. I wonder if what your response would be. They say a songwriter, and maybe this is true for other artists as well, but what we do, we're always kind of, each of us is kind of writing the same song over and over again. Does that land with you? Does that feel like it might be true?
That's kind of I can't think of the word, but sort of a scary thought, you know?
I mean, know. We're stuck in a rut.
Well, I guess I've thought in terms of, you know, that I've heard other people say this, that there are only so many things you can write about, or we do write about a lot of the same things, different ways of saying the same thing. Like, you know, love song, there's love, there's lust, there's, I can't remember what they all are now. Love, lust, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
There's certain, and, you know, you start to realize, you know, like, I mean, there are only so many things you can write about, I guess. I start digging around and trying to find more things. You know, that's what I've been trying to do since I started writing songs, probably.
Do you approach it, you feel like poetry? Do you think you're trying to build something with words and then make it work in the world of music?
Yeah. I think that, you know, unfortunately, I've been thinking about this a lot. I regret not having, see, here's a regret. It's not the same kind of regret, though. I regret not having studied creative writing, actually, you know, which is what my father taught in college. Just so I would, you know, I would understand the actual technical structures of, you know, poetry, and just sometimes I write something and I think, is this a poem? You know, or is this a song? Because my father was very adamant about the separation between poetry and songwriting. And he used to have these debates with some of his writing students about whether Bob Dylan was a poet or a songwriter. And they would say, he's a poet, he's a poet. And my dad would say, No, he's not a poet. He's a songwriter. There's a big difference. And there is a big difference, you know, because poetry, the words have to stand alone. I really learned this when I took a couple of my dad's poems and turned them into songs, you know, and that was really challenging because a poem doesn't necessarily have a refrain or a chorus, you know, so it's just a different structure.
Have you ever written something entirely without melody, as if it were a poem, just like rhymed couplets, and then retroactively built a song out of it?
I don't know if I've done that necessarily, but I've written, like I said, I've written a couple of things where I wondered if they could be poems, you know. And actually, one time I sent something to my dad, and I said, "Dad, is this, you know, what do you think about this?" I was trying to sort of search around and see if I could become a poet, I guess. And I sent him this something that I'd written, and he said, "Honey, I think this wants to be a song."
So it's funny he put it like that, because I think of that a lot. I feel like songs want things, like they're living things. And even when you're writing a song, you'll get to a point where, oh, this, now it wants to go to the chorus, or this.
Yeah.
You feel like that?
Yeah. Well, you have to get so foreign inside of it when you're writing a song. And it's so hard. Songwriting is so hard to explain. I'm always amazed at these, you know, songwriting convention things that they have, or whatever you call them, where people, you know, you have a class of, you have students, and you show them how to write songs, or, you know.
Yeah.
I've been asked to go to some of those, you know, and I've always been intimidated about, I don't know if I could explain how I do it, you know.
What do you think, if you had to do it, what would be maybe like your big thesis statement?
Well, I tell you, actually, this might be a good example. I was at Tootsie's in Nashville one night, and they used to have these kind of jam sessions there when I was living in Nashville before. And this young guy was there. He came and sat down next to me, and he was a fan and everything. And he said, "I want to know how you write songs. How do you do that? I just love your songs so much." And I said, just right off the top of my head, I said to him, "Well, first you have to dig deep down inside of yourself. You have to be willing and able to go to the darkest areas of yourself, you know, your mind, yourself, and, you know, look at it and take it and mold it and do whatever with it. And that becomes the song, you know." And he looked at me with this look on his face, like he was terrified almost. You know, he had this look like, oh no. It was the saddest thing I'd ever encountered, I think. He looked at me after I said that and said, "I don't think I can do that." And I thought, God, it broke my heart almost, you know, like I wanted to say to him, "Well, if you can't do that, then you're in trouble," you know, because that's the first thing I could think of that was important to be able to do as a songwriter and a poet, I think. And he said, "I don't think I can do that." And I said, "Well, then I guess you'll be working at Walmart. I don't know." No, I didn't say that.
No, of course you didn't. Oh, that's so good, though.
But, you know, that was an amazing encounter.
Do you feel like when you're working on a song, do you know what it's about?
Yeah, I feel like I need to know. I was just thinking of that yesterday, because I started working on a new song about people being hauled away to mental institutions, and, you know, because they don't fit in. And I got stuck at some point in the song. And I was thinking about this last night. I thought, okay, what am I trying to say here? I'm trying to come up with these lines that rhyme. I mean, I knew what I wanted to say to when I started it. But anyway, I have a framework in my mind, and I'm trying to think of other lines, and I'm frustrated right now because I've been battling with this song for the last week, you know.
It sounds like a tough subject.
Yeah, I have this image of, you know, this guy on the street maybe who's basically a warm-hearted individual, and, you know, somebody comes along and they become friends, and then at some point the guy gets taken, you know, his friend comes along the street one day and he's a homeless guy and he's not there, and then somebody else says, well, they came and took him away, you know. And so the person in the song is saying, they took him to the place where they take the ones who don't fit in. You know, I came up with that line, and then I was kind of like, okay, where do I go from there? You know? It reminded me of John Prine a little bit. You know how he always, he's so good about writing about he's so empathetic. He writes about these tragic figures, you know. And that's what I felt like I was doing, kind of. I realized that I was being influenced so much by John Prine at that point, you know.
The ones who don't fit in. Do you ever feel like that, like you're too rock and roll for whatever this kind of country world, or you're too country for the rock and roll world? Have you ever felt like a misfit like that?
A little bit, but that's mostly because other people have said that, you know, or made me feel that way. You know, the industry mostly, you know. I mean, I did a demo tape a long time ago. Where I had a development deal with Sony Records, and so they paid for me to do a demo tape, after which time they would decide whether they were going to sign me or not. So I did this demo tape, a bunch of great musicians on it, and they passed on it, but they sent it to Sony Records. This was in LA, and Sony in LA said it was too country for rock, so they sent it to Nashville. And Sony in Nashville said it was too rock for country. That was the beginning of my music falling in the cracks, between which, of course, became Americana. But yeah, so I've battled with that for a while.
I feel like you've had the last laugh. I mean, I hope that's how it feels to you, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Good.
Because a lot of labels passed on me. Back in the 80s when I was living in LA and I was trying to get a record deal, and, you know, Rounder Records even came and saw me play. I was playing at Raji's.
Yeah, I remember Raji's. That was a dump.
I know. Yeah. And, you know, they came and saw me play, and I didn't have my own band at that time. So I had a bunch of guys just sitting in with me. I think it was the Long Riders.
Oh, yeah.
Some of those guys. And Rounder said, you know, we really like your songs and everything and what you do, but we just don't feel like your show is really, you know, they said, you're not really ready to go on the road yet because it wasn't together enough, you know, or something like that.
God, your band is great now.
Thank you.
And you've been with those same guys for a while now.
Some of them, yeah, like Doug Pettibone.
Yeah.
On guitar. Yeah. He's been with me for a while.
Oh, Lou. Okay. Look, I don't want to keep you too much longer, but I got to ask you the big finale question, because you've shared a lot of wisdom, and people are going to love this. And I just wonder if you would try and sort of sum it up. and imagine a 21-year-old version of you.
Wow. And,
but in in today's messed up world, I'm wondering what advice you might give that little 21-year-old version.
Well, it's easy to say, but might not be the easiest thing to do, which would be, because I've thought about that myself, for myself even, you know, and it would probably be based on what I still deal with, which is insecurity sometimes and self-doubt. I would just say, you know, not to do that, you know, try to be, decide who you are and stick with that, you know, don't listen to too many people. You know, because there's all, everybody's got opinions, and there's always going to be somebody who says, you know, you need to dress differently, or you need to fix your teeth or something, you know. I mean, I think they told Debbie Harry to get a facelift or something, her record label. Somebody told me that, you know. So, I mean, there's going to be, it can go to that extreme, or it can just be, you know, where somebody telling you to wear a certain thing because you have to project a certain image or something like that. So that would be, that's not good advice, because it's so hard to do. I mean,
no, it's
okay, but it's okay to be insecure and feel vulnerable. Maybe that's the good advice. You're going to feel insecure. You're going to feel vulnerable. Wait, here's a good piece of advice. It goes back to what I told that kid at Tootsie's, which is, don't be afraid to go to the dark places, you know, as an artist. And my dad used to tell me, one time he said, never censor yourself. I think that's a good piece of advice.
I love that. Like, you could maybe deal with it in the second draft if you have to later.
Right.
But for sure. Oh, that's beautiful. You reminded me, Margot Price talks about record labels trying to make her get a nose job. I remember, I've heard just so many stories about all these different. I know.
I ran into a friend of mine, this guy, Bob Woodruff. That was his. Yeah, Bob Woodruff. He was in Nashville, and he was kind of more of a rocker guy, but kind of on the edge of that, and kind of like a Dwight Yoakam style thing. And I ran into him one night somewhere in Nashville, and he said, he was talking to this one label, and he said, Lou, he goes, I don't know what to do. And I said, what's going on? And he said, they want me to get my teeth fixed. What should I do? And I said, my initial response was, tell them they can kiss your whatever, you know, like, because I was like the rebel, you know, nobody's going to tell me what to do kind of thing. So I don't know what came of that, but, you know, that was always my initial response to anything like that was, you know.
I think you still might be that.
Oh, yeah. I'm definitely that.
Oh, Lou, I love this. I really appreciate you spending time with me.
This
and
is
I feel
great.
Like
I've never been up. We've never really sat and talked.
Not without a lot of other noise.
Yeah.
Well, you're so great.
You're sweet, too. You have a sweetness thing.
Well, thank you. And I think the world of you.
And you are so adorable.
Well, Lou, I
just had to say that.
I hope we get to share a stage someday really soon. And I just think the world of you.
Thank you. Remember that one we did? Was it in Dallas? That outdoor music thing?
Oh, yeah. You came and played the old 97s festival that we had with the big Ferris wheel.
Yeah. And Mavis Staples was there. And
yeah, Mavis was there that day.
That was fun.
God,
yeah.
that was of all the ones we had, I think that was my favorite. Having you and Mavis on there, that was magic.
Yeah.
Well, here's to many more. Thank you so much, Lou.
Thanks for having me.
All right. I'll see you soon.
Okay.
All right. Thank you so much for listening to Wheels Off. Please be sure to rate and review the show on iTunes. That helps us appear higher in the search results and lets other folks know that it's a cool podcast to listen to. Also, as the kids say, don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or anywhere else that you listen to shows like this so that you never miss an episode. This has been Wheels Off, and I'm Rhett Miller, encouraging you to create every day. Thanks, y'all.
Osiris.
The number you have reached is 100.7 WMMS.
It wasn't just a radio station, it was a lifestyle.
Cleveland is a rock and roll city for sure.
I do like the Chicago's.
Get down!
The Wrath of the Buzzard. WMMS. Cleveland.
The rise and fall of one of the most iconic radio stations in America. Profiles. The Wrath of the Buzzard. PROH Files. Subscribe now wherever you get podcasts.